Today is July the 21st, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. First space flight with an all-civilian crew. Blue Origin completed its first crew space flight with Jeff Bezos and three other on board yesterday. The crew aboard Blue Origin's launch on Tuesday took a giant leap into the unknown when they flew the first automated space flight with an all-civilian crew. Blue Origin yesterday just joined the ranks of private companies that have taken people to space. Jeff Bezos' outfit has successfully completed its first crewed space flight, taking Jeff Bezos and his brother, former female astronaut Wally Funk, and paying customer 18-year-old Oliver Damon beyond the Kármán line, which is 62 miles above the Earth, before their capsule returned to the desert. The flight broke multiple records. It included both the oldest ever astronaut, Wally Funk is 82 years old, an 82-year young octogenarian, and the youngest, Oliver Damon, 18 years old. Wally Funk fulfills lifelong dream to go to space with Blue Origin flight. The 82-year-old Wally Funk became the oldest person to go to space, and six decades ago after being denied by the U.S. government. Wally Funk, a pilot who was denied the chance to go into space in the 1960s because she was a woman. Funk, now 82, became the oldest person in space, six decades after she took part in the U.S. government testing to become an astronaut, a program the government abandoned in 1962. She said, "I've been waiting a long time to finally get up there, and I've done a lot of astronaut training through the world. Russia, America, and I can always beat the guys at what they were doing because I was always stronger, and I've always done everything on my own," Funk said at a news conference after the flight. Wally Funk was one of the Mercury 13 group of female pilots, also referred to as the First Lady Astronaut Trainees, who underwent psychological screening and rigorous physical testing with a view to taking part in NASA's early space efforts. The program was canceled in 1962 when the U.S. government said the women were not allowed to use military facilities required for training. "I'm glad times have changed. Wally Funk and all the others that went aboard that flight, when they landed, they were exuberant." For many years, there have been proposals sought to create IRS tax software or a return-free tax system. Hatched 17 years ago, under the terms of an agreement with the federal government, Intuit and other commercial tax prep companies promise to provide free online filing to tens of millions of lower-income taxpayers. In exchange, the IRS pledged not to create a government-run system. About 70% of people filing taxes in the United States, that's equal to roughly 100 million Americans, are eligible for a free program through the IRS, according to the agency. Even more may be able to file through other programs that offer tax preparation services at no or little cost. Last year, 4.2 million Americans used the free file program for the tax returns. The IRS processed more than 240.2 million federal tax returns and supplemental documents, of which nearly 195.2 million returns and other forms were filed electronically. With 100 million Americans eligible for a free program, 4.2 million used the free file program. Well, Intuit made an announcement last week. They will no longer be part of the IRS program that helps millions of Americans file taxes for free. Intuit announced it will no longer participate in the IRS Free File Program. IRS Free File Program helps millions of Americans file federal tax returns at no cost. People who still need to file their taxes and qualify for Free File can use Intuit's platform with the program through the end of October. Intuit, the company behind popular tax filing software TurboTax, announced that it will no longer participate in the IRS Free File Program, which helps millions of Americans submit tax returns at no cost. Intuit issued the following statement. With the Free File Program surpassing its founding goals of e-file and free tax preparation, and due to the limitations of the Free File Program and conflicting demands from outside the program, we are not able to continue in the program and deliver all the benefits that can help consumers make more money, save more, and invest for the future. The IRS Free File Program is a public-private partnership between the agency and the Free Alliance, a group of tax preparation companies with online software such as TurboTax, TaxAct, FreeTax USA, and more. It was a program for Americans with an AGI or adjusted gross income of less than $72,000 to file federal taxes with no cost. Intuit has been a part of the program for nearly 20 years. Part of Intuit's reasoning for leaving the program is its success. Today, this is what they said, over 90% of all taxpayers e-file their taxes, and free tax preparation is currently available to 100% of American taxpayers through a combination of commercial, philanthropic, and IRS-sponsored methods. The company also stated that they are proud that Intuit's participation in the Free File Program has helped the organization exceed its charter of increasing electronic filing to 80% and making free tax preparation available to 70% of filers. In the last tax season, Intuit delivered 17 million free tax filings, including roughly 3 million through IRS Free File, according to the company. For the last 8 years, nearly 90% of the approximately 100 million free filings done through the company have been outside Free File. Intuit says not working with the IRS program will mean fewer constraints going forward. This decision will allow us to focus on further innovating in ways not allowable under the current Free File guidelines and to better serve the complete financial health of all Americans through our products and services. In tax preparation and beyond, the company wrote in their recent blog. To be sure, Americans who still need to file 2020 tax returns and are eligible for IRS Free File Program can continue to select Intuit's software through October, when the tax season ends. The company will not offer services with Free File next year. Well, there are other members of the Free File Alliance with the IRS that will file your taxes if your AGI is under $72,000. There's 1040 Now Corporation, that's 1040 Now Corporation. There's Easy, that's Easy, TaxReturn.com. There's File Your Taxes, Free Tax Returns, Online Taxes, TaxAct, that's TaxAct, TaxHawk, that's TaxHawk, and TaxSlayer, SlayeR. Those are the ones that are part of the Free File Alliance. There is another one that I've used, and that's Credit Karma, and they've been offering a full-fledged free tax preparation return program with filing, however, for only one state tax return, and there is no restrictions on what the AGI is. Late last year, Intuit bought out Credit Karma. In late November, the Department of Justice announced it is requiring Intuit, Inc. and Credit Karma to divest Credit Karma's tax business. Credit Karma Tax is now moved to Square, Inc. in order for Intuit, the creator of TurboTax, to proceed with the $7.1 billion acquisition of Credit Karma. This announcement was followed by Square, Inc., entering into a definitive agreement with Credit Karma to acquire its tax business. Credit Karma Tax, on behalf of Cash App, the financial service app that allows individuals to spend, send, store, and invest money. On December the 8th of last year, Intuit completed the acquisition of Credit Karma. Credit Karma, which got its start offering consumers free access to their credit scores and reports, started offering tax preparation services in 2017. Other tax services typically only offer free preparation to filers below a certain income level by participating in the IRS Free File Program. Cash App has announced that Credit Karma Tax will continue to be everything you love, including free. I have to tell you, I've compared the results of Credit Karma with TurboTax. I got it down to almost the same in terms of feature for feature, except for two things. Credit Karma will enter data to the nearest dollar, whereas TurboTax allow you to enter the data to the exact cent. The only other difference was, with TurboTax, you can use it for more than one state return, whereas with the present form of Credit Karma, only one state tax return could be used. And for those who are doing gig work, where they live in one state and they're paid out of another state, well, your choice is easy. You might look at some of the other or free offerings with Free File Alliance if your AGI is less than $72,000. Or if you're making more than that, you can afford to go buy a full package from any one of the tax prep services. The Hubble Space Telescope was down on June the 13th when an onboard computer suddenly grounded to a halt. All science instruments on Hubble went into safe mode as a result, and had been that way since. The telescope is otherwise fine, but the normal operations had been suspended. The problem is with the payload computer, which controls and monitors Hubble's science instruments. It's the most serious glitch to afflict Hubble in years, raising concerns that the aging telescope might finally be finished. It was launched in 1990. Hubble has conducted over 1.5 million observations and contributed significantly to our understanding of the solar system, galaxies, and the universe in general. The Hubble recovery team has tried all sorts of tests over the past few weeks, along with attempts to restart and reconfigure the payload computer, but nothing has worked. Data collected during these attempts has now led the team to determine that the possible cause of the glitch has something to do with the power control unit, that's the PCU, located on the telescope's science instrument command and data handling unit. The PCU supplies electricity to the payload computer, equipped with a power regulator. The PCU provides a steady 5 volts of electricity to both the payload computer and its memory modules. A secondary protection circuit senses the voltage levels, leaving the power regulator. If the voltage falls below or exceeds allowable levels, this secondary circuit tells the payload computer that it should cease operations. The team's analysis suggests that either the voltage level from the regulator is outside of acceptable levels, thereby tripping the secondary protection circuit, or the secondary protection circuit has degraded over time and is stuck in this inhibited state. By the way, translation, there was a power supply problem. And like PCs, you need that steady 5 volts. It just wasn't there. Hubble has experienced a slew of other problems over the years, but NASA always seemed to find a way to bring the telescope back. Hubble may be old. It's over 30 years old, but it's expected to remain in operation until the 2030s. Should all go well, and should Hubble return to service, it could serve alongside the upcoming James Webb Space Telescope, which is scheduled to be launched later this year. Then, all of a sudden, I get the news that the Hubble Space Telescope has a new lease on life. The iconic, but elderly, Hubble Space Telescope appears to have been resurrected again after a shutdown of more than a month following a, well, they call it a computer glitch. A switch from the operating payload control computer to a backup device over the past 24 hours enable Hubble's operators to reestablish communications with all the telescope's instruments and now plans are to return all instruments to normal operations. And the cry was, Hubble is back! The head of the Hubble Mission Office emailed to the staff at the Space Telescope Science Institute last Friday at about 6 a.m. in the morning. I am excited to watch Hubble get back to exploring the universe. The head of the mission told his colleagues this morning that Hubble was successfully recovered into normal mode on Side A. This marked the first time we were able to progress beyond the problem that we are seeing on Side B. He said that if all continues normally, Hubble will restart science observations within a week. Astronomer Richard Ellis of University College London, who was talking with Science when the news came in, says, "You have to tell everyone how nervous we all were. The telescope," he says, "has always been a truly global facility. Everyone is a friend of Hubble. It's unique." What they did was they went to the backup system where there was a power supply. And this should be a lesson for all. The reason why you have backup is you have a mission-critical job, and in this case, it was a mission-critical job with Hubble. There was backup equipment. They went through all the procedures. And remember now, they do periodic fire drills so they know what the steps are, because very often when we know what the recovery steps are, we never go through a fire drill to re-familiarize ourselves with what it is. It took them more than a month, but they're up and running. The Hubble telescope has enabled us to learn an awful lot about the world or the universe or the solar system that we live in. The FCC voted to finalize a program subsidizing costs for small telecom firms to rip and replace Huawei and ZTE equipment. The U.S. government has considered the Chinese firms a national security. In a unanimous vote on Tuesday, the Federal Communications Commission finalized a $1.9 billion program to rip and replace equipment from Chinese telecom companies considered national security risk by the U.S. government. The program is meant to subsidize the cost for small telecommunications companies in the United States to replace gear from firms like Huawei and ZTE in an effort to secure U.S. networks. To be eligible for the funds, U.S. telecom firms must serve 10 million or fewer customers. That's a higher threshold than the previous 2 million or fewer figure in an earlier version of the order. Eligible companies that obtain equipment from companies like Huawei or ZTE prior to June 30th of 2020 can apply to be reimbursed for their replacement costs. U.S. officials have long complained Chinese companies are beholden to the People's Republic of China and collect sensitive information on behalf of the People's Liberation Army. The Chinese Communist Party has previously said that it does not engage in industrial espionage. Under former President Donald Trump, the U.S. added a slew of Chinese companies to its economic blacklist. These included the country's top smartphone maker, Huawei, lead chipmaker, SMIC, and the largest drone manufacturer, SZDJI Technology. In an effort to further isolate China's Huawei, the world's largest telecommunications equipment manufacturer, President Trump pushed U.S. partner countries to deny Huawei access to their 5G networks. The Trump administration specifically worked to keep members of the Five Eyes, that's EYES, intelligence sharing group, the U.S., U.K., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand from working with Huawei. Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo previously described Huawei and other Chinese state-backed tech companies as Trojan horses for Chinese intelligence. In April, the Biden administration added seven Chinese supercomputing entities to a U.S. economic blacklist, citing national security concerns. The Commerce Department added Tianjin FTM Information Technology, Shanghai High Performance Integrated Circuit Design Center, Sunway Microelectronics, the National Supercomputing Center Jinan, the National Supercomputing Center Shenzhen, the National Supercomputing Center Wuxi, and the National Supercomputing Center Shenzhou to its blacklist. The seven entities were blacklisted for building supercomputers used by China's military actors. It's destabilizing military modernization efforts and or weapons of mass destruction programs. Supercomputing capabilities are vital for the development of many, perhaps almost all modern weapons and national security systems, such as nuclear weapons and hypersonic weapons. The U.S. Secretary of Commerce, Gina Raimondo, wrote in an April 8th statement. Huawei USA Vice President Glenn Schloss said in a statement that the company was disappointed by the vote, calling the program an unrealistic attempt to fix what isn't broken. The FCC initiative only creates extraordinary challenges for carriers in the most rural and remote areas of the United States to maintain the same high level and quality of service they provide to their customers without disruption. Schloss said, adding that the FCC was using policy in an effort to make a geopolitical statement. Representatives for ZTE and the Chinese embassy did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Microsoft to offer cloud-based version of Windows operating system. Microsoft last Wednesday said it will offer its Windows operating system as a cloud-based service, aiming to make it easier to access business apps that needs Windows from a broader range of devices. It's called Windows 365, as the service will be called, and it will start rolling out on August the 2nd and will work somewhat like buying a new Windows PC. A business or school will pick how much computing power, memory, and storage they would like for an all-new machine. But instead of waiting for a physical machine to arrive in the mail, the employee or student will access the operating system in the cloud via the existing PC, a Mac, iPhone, Android phone, or even a Chromebook, as long as it has a web browser compatible with HTML5, a widely used internet standard. The cloud-based version was created in response to feedback from clients who wanted employees and students to have quicker and easier PC access regardless of physical location. We define that shift to hybrid work as really being flexibility in how, when, and where you work. That's really the pattern that we're seeing develop all across the world as people are starting to experiment, said Jaro Spataro, Corporate Vice President for Microsoft 365 Software. The service akin to so-called virtual and remote desktops that have been around for decades, but which require a sophisticated IT department to set up and manage. Those costs can also be unpredictable because they are based on how much the desktops are used. Microsoft hopes the Windows 365 technology will be easy enough for small business owners or smaller schools to introduce without a large IT department, with a predictable monthly bill based on the size of each virtual computer. Andrew Hewitt, an analyst at Forrester Research, said the move would also help Microsoft defend its dominant market share in the face of strong competition from operating systems from Apple and Alphabet Google that are easier for schools and businesses to manage. My personal opinion is this is a great idea because you can now make easy maintenance, modifications, and changes across the board very quickly. The only downside is if the internet is down, a lot of families will be sitting there idle. Perhaps it coincides with school, but many major companies are planning on returning back to the office starting in September. Employees at Apple say the company's cracking down on remote work. One employee said that Apple even denied Americans with Disabilities Act work-from-home accommodation. Apple employees said it's harder than ever to get remote work requests approved after the company released a new hybrid model that would require people to return to the office 3 days a week starting in early September. Some employees say they will quit if Apple doesn't change its stance. While Apple historically discouraged employees from working from home, there were exceptions to the rule, and some teams were more lenient than others. Now, employees say that even those exceptions are being denied. In a company's Slack channel, where employees advocate for remote work, roughly 10 people said that they were resigning due to the hybrid work policy or knew others who had been forced to quit. The Slack channel currently has more than 6,000 members. In a survey on remote work conducted by employees in June, 36.7% of respondents said that they were worried they have to leave Apple due to the lack of flexibility. Over 1,700 people answered the questionnaire. The return-to-work plan has already been a flashpoint at Apple, where employees wrote a letter in June asking Apple CEO Tim Cook to reevaluate the hybrid model. Apple sent a video in response saying that in-person collaboration was essential and noting the company would not be backing away from its current approach. Some say it's out of step with other big tech companies in Silicon Valley. Twitter and Facebook have already announced a permanent work-from-home policy, and Apple employees say they've been flooded with recruiting messages from other tech organizations eyeing a potential opportunity. One employee said that he was currently on an American with Disabilities Act accommodation that allows him to work from home, but we're told that accommodation would be denied when the company went back to the office. Apple typically gives employees 30 days to find a new job within the company if their current team denies a medical accommodation. But one worker said in Slack, there weren't any open remote positions. Some employees say they were told only people with documented medical conditions would be approved for medical remote work. But the form that Apple employees used to request such an accommodation asked them to release their medical records to the company, which made some people uncomfortable. Now employees are discussing how to get Apple's attention. Some suggest writing another letter to reiterate their concerns, while others have discussed talking to lawyers about possible legal action. And this is on top of what Google had already announced, that they will have remote work, but they will be adjusting the salary anywhere from a cut of 15 to 25% depending on the location of where the remote work is. There has been considerable amount of hype over the promise of 5G. Industry groups say it will promote smart cities by connecting sensor networks that could manage traffic and quickly identify streetlight outages. 5G could connect self-driving cars and fuel new applications in virtual and augmented reality. The regular 5G, meanwhile, is real 5G, but only on the mid-band and low-band flavors. AT&T use of 5G Plus will be for the carrier's millimeter wave service. How far can 5G waves travel? 1,000 feet. 5G wavelengths have a range of about 1,000 feet, not even 2% of 4G's range. So to ensure a reliable 5G signal, there needs to be a lot of 5G cell towers and antennas everywhere. We're talking on every lamppost, traffic light, on every other city block. Because even trees can block 5G signals, millimeter wave doesn't penetrate walls. Wood and glass attenuate high-frequency signals to a small degree, so you'll likely still be able to use 5G millimeter wave next to a window. However, massive MIMO and beamforming ensure that strict line of sight isn't a requirement to make use of millimeter wave. Very high-frequency 5G signals don't travel very far and don't transition very well from indoors to outdoors. A millimeter wave signal may not be able to penetrate buildings. In summary, people would just have to rely more on sub-6 gigahertz and LTE signals. So in the recently released Open Signal report, barely anyone was using millimeter wave 5G in the United States. Although 5G adoption in the United States has seen a massive uptick in the last few months, a recent Open Signal report suggests that barely anyone is using millimeter wave 5G. According to the report, Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile users connect to a millimeter wave 5G network, get this now, less than 1% of the time. The millimeter wave 5G experience report reveals that Verizon users experience the highest average time connected to a millimeter wave 5G network at 0.7%, While T-Mobile and AT&T users connect to a millimeter wave 5G network just 0.4% and 2% of the time. If you're wondering why millimeter wave 5G has such a low rate of adoption, it's because the technology has glaring shortcomings. As was explained in the definitive guide to 5G, although millimeter wave 5G offers significantly higher speeds and lower latency than sub-6 GHz 5G, it has limitations. To begin with, millimeter wave 5G requires a line of sight to the carrier installed node. That's because it uses incredibly high radio frequencies that are easily blocked by obstacles. On top of that, these frequencies have a limited range of about 500 meters. Due to these reasons, carriers would have to install a node on every street in every neighborhood to offer users a seamless experience. Since that's highly impractical, most users never have access to millimeter wave signal. Despite the poor rate of adoption, though, millimeter wave 5G from all major carriers continues to offer impressive download speeds. Open Signal's report reveals that Verizon offers the fastest average millimeter wave 5G download speed of over 600 megabits per second. In comparison, T-Mobile's average clocked in at slightly over 300 megabits per second, while AT&T users only got an average download of about 245 megabits per second. There's been a lot of hype on 5G, and there's a lot of misunderstanding on what 5G can and can't do. And in reality, the person getting 5G is getting 5G, but not the expected millimeter 5G that has been hyped. Google admits employees listen to conversations recorded by Google Assistant even without the user's Hey Google or OK Google trigger. The tech giant made the admission during a closed-door meeting with Indian government officials, according to a report, though Google has attempted to clarify the claims. Sources also told India Today the company admitted that its artificial intelligence assistant would at times record audio on a smartphone or smart speaker even when it hasn't been summoned. Google clarified how the assistant system works in a statement to Android Authority. In standby mode, the device processes short snippets of audio, a few seconds, to detect an activation, like when you say, Hey Google. If no activation is detected, then those audio snippets won't be sent or saved to Google. The statement also noted that when the assistant detects its wake word, the recording can include a few seconds before you activate your assistant to catch your request at the right time. Google has previously admitted that employees listen to short recordings to improve language comprehension in its products. As part of our work to develop speech technology for more languages, we partner with language experts around the world who understand the nuances and accents of a specific language, said product manager for Google Search. These language experts review and transcript a small set of queries to help us better understand those languages. This is a critical part of the process of building speech technology and is necessary to create products like the Google Assistant. Google has since changed its policies, requiring Home or Nest users to opt into having voice searches recorded in the first place, in response to the backlash. If you're unsure of whether you're opted in or out, or if you're just curious to know what Google's recording about you, there are ways to check. All of your Google activity can be found in the My Activities section of your Google account. In there, you'll find everything from your Google Maps entries to your search engine queries. You can read a list in the Google Home app or actually listen back to your own voice search history if it has been recorded. Thankfully, you can easily erase your history by deleting recordings on your PC and deleting your recordings on your phone. If you have previously opted in to Google saving your audio or voice commands, you can easily stop the devices from doing so. However, it will cause voice searching with Google Assistant to stop working until it's re-enabled. On a PC, you can access the feature by clicking on the settings bar in the top left-hand corner of myactivity.google.com. From there, hit Activity Controls on the menu and toggle audio recordings on or off. Google asks if you're sure and tell you a bit more about what pausing voice and audio means. Well, this is just for the Google Home Assistant. Now I gotta find out what it is for Amazon Echo, because I've gotten interruptions without commanding Alexa to come on to hear a command. Big Brother is surely watching over us, and we have to be careful. We have one of two options. Actually, we have one of three options. One is place the Google Assistant and the Amazon Echo devices in one room that you go to when you need it, or have a designated quiet room that you go to where you want none of those devices to listen in on you. The third option is get rid of the devices. Enough is enough. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his continuing IT Pro Series, What I Dread in IT.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where I talk about the workplace. This is where I talk about professional IT. This is where I talk about, well, you get the idea. We go down a number of different roads each week along this topic and all of its related items. And Lori reached out to me, and Lori asked me, what is the thing that you dread, what I dread, the most in professional IT? And, you know, I'll tell you, it's not the callers. It's not the people who reach out to me with computer questions, with technology questions, with their problems, with any of that. I enjoy that. I thrive on that. It's, you know, I want to be careful on how I say this, because I don't want it to come across wrong, but along the lines of it's not an ego boost, because I don't think of it quite as an ego boost, but I like to help people. And I think that's kind of where I'm going with this. I like to help people, and it feels good to me to be of help to people. I am in the church world, one of my gifts is being of service. I love to help out wherever I can. So this is just, it comes naturally to me. Now I'll tell you the next item that comes to mind about what is the thing I dread most in professional IT. It's not the problems themselves, because I thrive on mysteries. I thrive on solving these different things. It's very similar to solving the problems for people and helping them out, but also trying to figure out why this computer is broken, trying to figure out what it could have been. And I will tell you that I frequently will discuss things with people after I fix their computer, you know, through them asking me questions. They'll ask me, you know, 5-10 questions. I'll say, try this, try that, try this, try that, try this, and then give me a holler back if none of those work. Actually, I want you to give me a holler back and tell me which one of those worked. And usually it's the first or second one. Sometimes it's the third one. But it gives me more of that knowledge in computing. I will tell you, the thing that I dread the most when we're talking about in my professional IT world, and this has happened over the years, it's whenever I hear something that went wrong, and I have no information beyond that. I know something went wrong, and I don't know if that impacted me, if that was something I broke, if that was something that somebody else did, if I, you know, violated some rule, if I forgot something, whatever it is. The funny thing is, I will tell you, I had an incident like this just a matter of about a week or two ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, whatever it was. And it was just a matter of, I was sitting there and I knew we were going to discuss this, myself and one of my coworkers, and it was not good. I had already gotten the idea that just because of the way we were doing this, it was not good. Fortunately, like so many times, no, I didn't do anything wrong. I did everything absolutely right. It was, how do we handle this person? How do we treat the issue that went wrong? How do we address this? And so forth. But I'll tell you, it's that interim time period. And we all do this to some extent. It is almost superhuman to not worry. It's superhuman to not have some doubts along the way. And I think for me personally, I too easily dread these things. I too easily fall into the trap of worrying and not putting my faith in God, in the work that I do, my experience, my overall knowledge over the years. And look, how do I deal with this? How do I set this all aside? How do I prevent that internal panic? And the answer is, well, usually once I realize the panic is there, I start working on setting it aside. And I go, look, I've got this knowledge and I've got this experience and I've done this for however long, and it's perfectly fine. Everyone makes mistakes. I'll tell you that I've seen people make very expensive mistakes. We have this concern. Oh, I make a mistake in the job office, on the job, in the workplace, and I'm all of a sudden going to lose my job. I will tell you that most companies, you have to not mess up once, but you have to mess up a number of times, and you have to be particularly bad at your mistakes. You have to keep doing the same problems over and over again. If you're always making new mistakes, that's a little different too. Because if you're always making new mistakes, even though you're making a lot of them, it means you're learning from your old mistakes. Some of our jobs have a lot of different areas where things can go wrong. And our employers, and I'm speaking both from an employee perspective and from an employer perspective, having supervised many people, I'll tell you, if somebody's making the same mistake again and again, oh, and again and again, really, we've discussed this, a dozen times in the last 6 weeks, that's going to be more painful for me than, oh, you broke this, that's fine. Oh, you made a mistake here, that's fine. You did this wrong, that's fine. As long as you're learning, as long as you're getting better, because we do get struck with some of these different, I don't want to call them bad luck, but that's probably the best term I've got at the immediate moment. So there you go. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The chip shortage is going to get worse before it gets better. One of tech's biggest problems in the past few months has been electronic chip shortages. The effects have impacted almost all industry sectors. The car companies are being hit the worst. Chip manufacturer Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company has reiterated that it expects chip shortages to continue well into next year. As the world's largest contract chip manufacturer, a lot of attention has been paid to Taiwan Semiconductor amid the global chip shortage, which has impacted the manufacturing of everything from cars to game consoles. Taiwan Semiconductor is a leading manufacturer of semiconductors and is responsible for producing the majority of smartphone processors worldwide. It supplies chips to the world's biggest tech companies, including Apple, Qualcomm, and AMD, and controls 28% of the world's semiconductor production capacity. Taiwan Semiconductor warns that chip shortages will last into 2022, and other companies have issued warnings along a similar timeline. Amid the continual shortages, all eyes on how quickly Taiwan Semiconductor can increase production. The company has committed to spending $100 billion through 2023 to expand its capacity, and in this year alone, it expects microcontroller production to increase by almost 60%. Last month, the company started construction of a new $12 billion semiconductor manufacturing facility in Arizona, and in April, it confirmed it would spend $2.8 billion expanding production in Nanjing, China. The company is also considering building its first chip plant in Japan. In the meantime, the chip shortage is continuing to have a real impact on the electronics available for people to buy. Just this week, General Motors said it would drop wireless smartphone charging from some of its new SUVs because of supply chain challenges, and shortages are also starting to cause a slowdown in the PC market. There is no quick fix to increasing the available supply. You cannot just build a chip manufacturing plant in a short space of time. The factories that build the chips are typically referred to as semiconductor foundries. They cost between $10 to $20 billion and can take 3 to 5 years to build. Earlier this year, companies expected to have supply chains sorted and products more consistently back on shelves by the summer. But July is nearly over, and there's seemingly no end in sight. With the upcoming slate of new tech releases and the holiday shopping season coming up, we should expect things to get worse before they get better. Many thought the chip shortage would be only for 6 or 7 months, and that it would be for a relatively short term. We're in this for the next 12 to 18 months, and chips could be in short supply for years. Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger commented in a Wall Street Journal interview back in April that it could be 2 years before production is able to ramp up. This will take a while until people can put more capacity in the ground. AMD CEO Dr. Lisa Su noted at a May investor event that the company was being forced to prioritize its higher-end chips over lower-powered parts due to the shortages. There are two different forces at work here. For some products, there's too much demand, which impacts the higher-end chips like GPUs in a PlayStation 5 or an RTX 3080 graphic card. While chip shortages have undoubtedly played a part, there's also simply more people who want to buy these products than there are enough to go around. The unexpected increases in demand in many sectors cannot be met by the ability to generate the needed supply. On the other hand, take GPUs, which have finally started to drop in price over the past few weeks. Not because NVIDIA has magically figured out how to churn out more parts, but because of demand is finally slowing down following plummeting Bitcoin prices and China's crackdown on cryptocurrencies. In order for cryptocurrencies to succeed, there is what is called crypto mining, where the GPU cards are needed to do all the processing. It's in the chip makers' interest to keep trying to churn out those parts. Newer chips are more lucrative. If you are Taiwan Semiconductor or Samsung, it's in your best interest to focus on making and expanding those production efforts. On the flip side, though, are supply issues, particularly for older chip designs. Unlike a new iPhone or Xbox, a Ford truck or a John Deere tractor doesn't need bleeding-edge technology chips using Taiwan Semiconductor or Samsung's 5-nanometer process. They just use the older chips, which are less powerful and cost less than the ones using brand new technology. Older chips, like the ones used in cars, are being hit particularly hard. The impact here is already being felt. A Bloomberg report from last month notes that car makers are starting to skip out on offering premium features like navigation systems or extra screens in order to stretch their supply of chips further. NVIDIA repurposed old GPUs into special cryptocurrency mining boards to free up more supply of newer ones for gamers. Even Apple noted that it was running into trouble getting a hold of those older chips due to the extra competition. Automotive semiconductors have been pretty outdated. Automakers either have to invest in upgrading to newer technologies more on par with consumer devices, or foundries are needed to build out more capacity for those specific legacy chips, parts which aren't really useful for phones or laptops. Exacerbating the issue is that on a broader scale, the semiconductor industry has become increasingly consolidated. Despite the increasing importance of computer chips in virtually every hardware product across multiple industries, the number of companies that make those chips, especially specialized chip at the high end of the market, have grown increasingly fewer in numbers. Taiwan Semiconductor alone accounts for 92% of the supply of cutting-edge chips, with Samsung providing the rest. According to a Wall Street Journal report, the company also reportedly makes about 60% of the chips for car manufacturers around the world, which means that when those companies run out of capacity, there's not a lot of other places to go to get those processors. That's also why chip shortages likely won't hit some of the biggest devices, like Apple's next iPhone or whatever Samsung's 4 flagship ends up being, at least not as hard as they hit Ford trucks or GPUs. DigiTimes reports that Taiwan Semiconductor is already prioritizing Apple's orders along with those of car manufacturers heading into the fall. Because of the size and scale of Apple's orders, think of how many iPhones it sells every year, or using cutting-edge chips from Taiwan Semiconductor, it has the pull to stay at the front of the line. The bad news is that the crunch will probably get worse before it gets better. Taiwan Semiconductor, Intel, Samsung are all heavily investing in expanding and building new fabs. The Biden administration is also trying to help, pushing to pump billions into U.S. semiconductor manufacturing. But as Intel CEO noted, it's going to take months, if not a few years, for those investments to mature. With the holiday season fast approaching and a new wave of products from across market segments all fighting for chips, there's almost certainly bound to be more product delays, cut corners, price jumps, and part shortages to come. If you think you might need some additional computing equipment, you might want to think ahead of time and start ordering it now or think of an alternative. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, July the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC User Group meets Thursday, August the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, August the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi, that's J-I-T-S-I, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, August the 12th, 2021 at 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, August the 13th, 2021 at 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.